welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. We here at the Enquirer are doing a lot of Bengals prep at the moment, but it is still Cincinnati Reds season. It's kind of wrapping up, and so we wanted to circle back and kind of get some perspective this week. So I'm here with Burl Love, my co-host, and we are going to have on Jeff the Cowboy Brantley. And since I think you all know that I don't probably know where he gets that nickname, that's definitely going to be asked here today. So I'm excited to talk to some Reds today, and I know that Burl is, because I know he's a big fan.
Even if we weren't trying to wrap up the Reds season, and yes, we're all crazy for the Bengals right now and the white helmets. And gosh, speaking of the white helmets, if they get blown out by the Dolphins, will the white helmets be like destroyed and never to be seen again?
You know what? I was actually wondering that, because there's so much superstition wrapped up around sports.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, well, what happens if this doesn't go well? I mean, they'll still be cool. I'm a big fan of them. I like how they look and everything. And there's been so much excitement around them. But you know what?
But back to baseball. We know the Reds.
We're going to win. So I'm just, that's it. Like, I'm looking forward to going to the Super Bowl. Like, we're just all positive energy around these things.
Totally positive energy. And, you know, it's nice to talk to someone from the Reds as the season winds down. But Brantley's one of those guys that is just fun to talk to no matter what.
He's a good storyteller, too.
Good storyteller, good character.
Podcast guest. Yes.
You know, people love listening to him on the radio. So I'm looking forward to just having a casual chat with Jeff. But I have to tell you, Sherry, I got a couple emails from people who, you know, we talked a little politics at the beginning of the last podcast. We kind of got off of our run with food and all the fun things happening. We dug into some politics.
It was summer.
I know, but these email writers were like, oh my gosh, I'm glad you're talking politics at the beginning of the podcast.
We're again in the thick of it. I cover the city, you know, so I'm not really covering these races per se. I talk about these races all day, every day now. People have a lot of questions. Some I can answer, some I can't. I'm following it as a citizen. So let's dig in.
Well, I want to dig into and you'll see why this is a tad self-serving, but the race for governor, it looks like it's a little lopsided now, according to the polls. Mike DeWine has a double-digit lead over
It's more than that. It's like the biggest spread I think we've ever seen.
Well, it can't be more than double-digit. It would be a triple-digit lead. It would be like 100 points. So.
Okay.
All right, yeah. But anyway, that's math.
Yeah, all right.
And now you know, folks, how editors and reporters talk about math. But anyway.
This is true.
Mike DeWine has not, as we record, agreed to debate Nan Whaley. And so in a rather unprecedented, but not totally unprecedented move, the Cincinnati Enquirer and its sister publications, including the Columbus Dispatch and the Akron Beacon Journal, that we all are under the USA Today Network Ohio flag, wrote and published a joint editorial taking DeWine to task for not debating, and also criticizing the Vance campaign for refusing to participate in a debate hosted by the Ohio Debate Commission. So just backing up a second, the point we're trying to make is that the tradition of the debate, which goes back decades now, I think is an integral part of the political process. And even though DeWine probably from a political strategy point of view, you can understand why he has nothing to win, everything to lose by participating in a debate because of his polling numbers. I think he still owes it to his candidate or his opponent and the voters to participate in a debate.
So I do want to talk about the Senate race too, but let's stay on this one. You know, we mentioned this in passing last week, and I've had a lot of time to think about it. And so as long as we're talking about the podcast, I actually reached out to the governor because he's the governor and asked him to be on the podcast. And the answer was no, not at this time. It was nice with his people and everything. And I still hope he'll come on. But even in my head, we do try and keep the podcast a little light, but you cannot be any, if you're a reporter in this state, you cannot have a conversation with Governor DeWine and not ask him about House Bill 6. It's just you can't.
I agree.
And so that, I think, is what the sticking point is. I do not think that Governor DeWine is afraid to debate Nan Whaley. Yes, like as a political strategy, he doesn't really have any, he doesn't need it. He doesn't have anything to gain from it per
se. And remind listeners about House Bill 6.
House Bill 6 is the energy scandal in which people were indicted for, it's so complicated, in which people, like, you know, householder.
It was the bailout bill.
Yes, of the energy companies. And it was going to cost taxpayers $2 billion. And the fix was in on getting it done, and is the allegation. That trial is actually starting at the end of January. You can expect that kind of coverage to be like the Sittenfeld coverage for us. We're already prepping for it. And I ask all the time because I'm interested in some other federal, I'm really off topic here, because I am interested in some other federal cases coming up. Is that going? Which is important because these cases move and they move and they move and they move. And I keep hearing the same answer. It's going. So this trial is going to be happening. And I do not think that the governor wants to talk about that. And that's what the sticking point is, even though it would be nice to hear that. I'm sure he's happy to say, I'm different than her. I'm better than her. And she'd say the same thing. He's not afraid to say why. He doesn't want to answer that one question.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think when Nan Whaley was debating John Cranley in the primary, it was interesting to me because they didn't spend a lot of time debating each other because, frankly, you know, they're both Democrats in some of the, you know, one of the two largest, from one of the two largest, larger cities in Ohio. So there's not a lot that they differ on politically. They took their time debating to really make the argument that Mike DeWine needed to be out of his job because of his tie to the first energy bailout. So I think you're right about that. But I think there's also there's something else going on, and I think it kind of reared its head a little bit with the J.D. Vance campaign decision not to participate in the debate that was attempted to be organized by the Ohio Debate Commission. And that's the, I think, unfortunate I would say position that some in the Republican Party are taking that debates by their nature lean left because they're organized by media organizations, because the questions that get asked are often perceived as coming from the left agenda rather than the right agenda. And so the Vance campaign flat out said that the Ohio Debate Commission, which for those who don't know, was formed in 2018 by media organizations, civic groups, universities from across the state to increase or to lift the standards of debate, to add some professionalism, and also these organizations were often competing against each other to host debates, and it was just a very crowded field. So they felt that coming together would be an opportunity to have, like, you know, a debate of record, so to speak. And full disclosure, we are part of the Ohio Debate Commission. I serve on the board. But the Vance campaign was not shy about saying, you know, we're not doing this because the debate commission, I'll try to get that word out, leans left. And I think that's, for many reasons, a little dangerous when it comes to how divided our country is and how these are opportunities to get discussions going that could help bring us together.
No, I agree. Now, we should say there are two debates. One is going to be happening in Youngstown and one is happening in Cleveland, which is great. And all eyes will be on them as much as that we can and have them, you know, they'll have statewide coverage. But it's not the same as having something that everyone can see statewide themselves. But, you know, Southwest Ohio and everyone in politics in the state will tell you that it's a different animal than the rest of the state. It just is. And there are things that could be asked that are pertinent to Southwest Ohio. And that chance is not going to.
Right.
That's not going to be out
right
there now.
And I think, you know, if the Vance campaign is listening, the Cincinnati Inquirer would be happy to host a U.S. Senate debate in Southwest Ohio. The Ohio Debate Commission that's another area that it addresses, is that because it has members from all over the state, the format of the debate and the topics, it's important to the debate commission that issues are raised that affect Ohioans no matter where you live. But anyway, I could go on and on about that. I actually wrote about that in a column. So if anyone wants to dig into that more, you can go to Cincinnati.com. You can read the editorial. You can read my column, which gets into a little bit about the reason the Ohio Debate Commission was formed. But back to the Senate race, it is so close.
It is.
It is not one of those races where, you know, Tim Ryan or J.D. Vance can just sit back and let it play out. They're going to have to do something to distinguish themselves. A poll that we did with Suffolk University and our partners in the network showed them about a percentage point, you know, apart, with which is well within the margin of error. So it's anyone's race right now. What do you think, Sherry, since you watch this closely, tell me what you think is likely to play out in this race.
Well, first I should say I did get a survey call on Friday, and I paused because the first question that any survey person asks, are you with the radio, media, da, da, da. And I desperately wanted to know who was doing, because I would be able to read into the questions with my experience and understand like what's happening. And I wanted to know what they were asking and who was going to be asking the questions. But I paused for 1 second and then I was honest and I was like, I work for a media company. And that person also paused and I was like, was this for Vance Ryan? And they paused and I was like, and they're like, okay, thank you. And I was like, darn it.
Oh, so you didn't get your answer?
No, but I was like, I could tell. And I was like, oh.
Did you think for a second to take a few of the polling questions and then once you figured out what was going on, stop
did
and
you
say,
mean,
hey, wait a minute. Can you repeat that first question you asked me about being part of the media? I think I might have misunderstood it.
That was my hesitation.
Because I am part of the media. And then you could have. But that would have been, I think that would have been disingenuous. I'm glad.
100%.
I'm
would
glad
never.
I'm glad your ethics
exactly.
remained intact, Sherry, as much as you were tempted.
So it is very close, and I would never, ever, like, bet or predict this race. But, you know, the things I'm seeing, if you look at, like, registered, like, these are the kind of stories that maybe aren't, like, the main headlines of things, but, like, who's registering for voting. I've seen some stories around the state, including here, that you're seeing women registering to vote kind of here at the last minute. And you have to say to yourself, are they like, we're trying to get Nan Whaley over the edge? No, that is not why a woman is registering to vote right now. I'm sorry, maybe some, but that's not like, there's not a groundswell of people being like, oh no, we could pull her over this double digit, you know, divide here. That really is going, this abortion issue and what's happening in Ohio is driving women to register to vote. And I feel like that is going in Tim Ryan's favor. And that's where that's coming from. But you can only guess because you don't ask that question. There's not exit polling. There's no way to really know, except if people are taking these polls and surveys and everything. And so that to me has been like an interesting underlying number to look at what's happening there.
So to wrap this up, and to give a little preview, we have a lot of reporting that's about to be completed and published about the abortion issue in Ohio. And also, your good friend and mine, Dan Horn, is working on a piece that looks at how Ohioans have shifted their views on that topic over the last 10 years. And we should bring him in and discuss that.
I would love to do that. Listeners, longtime listeners know I'm very good friends with Dan. And so I've had an inside look at what he's working on. And it's really some great storytelling because we did not get here by accident. And so I learned a lot just from talking to him. So I'm excited for people to be able to read this story. And it doesn't really take a look at let's not why people think this is good or this is bad. It's just how it came to be. And
exactly.
I love a good origin story.
It's
and
gonna
so
be
we
fantastic.
Should definitely do that.
Yeah, it's going to really, I think, provide some interesting perspective on how we got here. And I think the moment where we decided to answer that question, how we got here, was the big national story that broke when a 10-year-old rape victim from Ohio left Ohio after abortion restrictions went into place to get an abortion in Indiana. It became a national story, became a moment of self-reflection. And, you know, the story doesn't advocate one way or the other. Of course, we wouldn't do that. But it does, it is going to explain what happened to us politically, what happened to us culturally, that we found ourselves in that position. So more to come on that.
But with Haley B. Miller, he's not doing it alone.
That's correct.
So this is one of the nice things about when we say we have a sister paper, you know, there's been some media mergers and everything, but it has been just the most amazing thing to get to know the Columbus Dispatch reporters. And I think they know us and Akron, really, but we do statewide looks at things. But Haley and Dan did this together. And so it's helpful to have, you know, perspective from other cities.
All right. And with that, I think we're going to talk to the cowboy.
A lighthearted conversation.
I should have worn my cowboy boots.
Yes.
All right.
Welcome to special guest time on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to talk to today's guest, Jeff Brantley, the on-radio broadcaster for the Cincinnati Reds. I mean, it is still Reds season, so I was like, let's do this.
Well, I thought it would be great to have you on, Jeff, just because we're kind of wrapping up the season, and you're in Pittsburgh today, correct?
I am. I hope you can't hear the jackhammers on the Roberto Clemente Bridge.
No, we can't. But, you know, we're thrilled to have you on. We figured we would, you know, when we have guests on our podcast, we like our listeners to get to know the guest a little better. So, you know, we want to talk a little bit about you. We want to talk a little bit about, you know, how this Reds season went. That might be a little bit of a grim discussion. But also, you know, just your thoughts on everything happening, not just with the Reds, but you know, with the city, and you just have such a great way of providing insight. But the first thing I wanted to ask you is, for people unfamiliar with you, how long have you been called the cowboy, and how did that come about?
You know, I get that question a lot. And by the way, I'm really glad to be on with you guys. This is fun. I do love Cincinnati. I can tell you that from my heart. And I have since I was just a kid, you know, 10 years old, even though it took me a long time to finally get to the city. But as far as the cowboy name is concerned, that came back when I was playing with the Reds. And it's not like I'm a big horse rider or anything like that. I just like cowboy boots, and I like to wear them. And when we were when I was playing with the Reds, we had a big game, and I had ended up getting a save in the game, and you know, everybody's back in the locker room and we're all excited and guys are having a beer or two and just kind of sharing a bit of a moment. And, you know, my kids had come into town. So I was telling the guys, look, I can't stay long. I got to go. So I went, got in the shower and got dressed, and they're still all back there. And when I went back to say bye, I had the boots on, and Lenny Harris just yells out. He goes, well, there he goes, the cowboy riding off in the sunset. Well, the next day I get to the ballpark, somebody throws out the cowboy name here and somebody throws it out there. And the next thing you know, it just kind of stuck. It's kind of crazy.
And flash forward to 2022, where the Reds issue a Jeff Brantley bobblehead with cowboy hat and boots.
Yes, they did. How funny is that?
I think it was, I mean, I have one. I collect bobbleheads. That's going to have to be another podcast one day. But just for some background, your start with the majors was for the Giants for a couple,
yes,
almost 5 years. And then
yeah, I was with the Giants. I was in the minor leagues for 3 years, and then I played in the big leagues with them for just a little over 5 years, almost 6 years, I guess you could say.
So for just to catch people up, you joined the Reds 1994 and played, I believe, three seasons, including right, under manager Ray Knight.
That is correct. Yeah, I was actually there for 4 years. The final year, I was recovering from shoulder surgery. So I can remember when I when I hurt my arm, it was in spring training of 97, and I had to have shoulder surgery. And then I was doing my rehab, and back then the general manager was Jim Bowden. And Jim said, look, we need you to be back up here and be in the dugout with Jeff Shaw and some of the other guys in the bullpen. And I was like, Jim, I mean, I can't do it. I mean, it was my right arm. I couldn't eat. I could barely do anything. My wife had to help me pretty much with everything, and I mean everything that I was trying to do. And he said, I don't care what it is. He goes, we'll get you a maid. He goes, we'll make you a Velcro uniform, and that's what they did. So I end up back in Cincinnati, and I'm sitting in the dugout every day thinking, this is crazy. I mean, it's just crazy.
Can you even imagine doing, like, we've heard stories like Joey Votto, these last games has been going up in the stands and taking pictures with fans and everything. Everything's become, like, so social media and kind of a little more casual. Can you imagine doing that?
You know, I really like that. I think it's a testament to Votto and just his spirit. But back when we were playing, that would have been frowned upon, not only by your ownership, but by your teammates, because it would almost seem as though you were kind of just jacking around and not pulling for your club. And I just don't think that's what that's all about. I mean, if you have an opportunity to engage with the fans while you're playing and while you're in uniform, I mean, that's the best case scenario for not only the player, but especially for the folks that are sitting in the stands. I mean, how surprised did those folks look when Joey just came up and sat down beside him in the stands? So they kind of looked and did a double take, and they're like, oh my gosh, that's Joey Votto. It was great.
It almost reminded me of your good friend Tom Browning's experience, but that was a little bit of a different story, I believe.
Yeah, and Tom got killed for that.
Oh, he got fined and everything else. And for listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, well, you tell the story, Jeff.
Well, I mean, he's sitting up on the other side of Wrigley on one of the Wrigley rooftops in the middle of the game, and he's waving to the guys in the dugout. He's in full uniform and
drinking a beer with Cub fans.
He was drinking a beer. And everybody made it out to be a bad thing, and it was actually a really cool thing, to be honest with you.
No, especially with this season has been a tough season, and people are still going to the games. And then he's with kids on school nights and everything else, and it's nice to see. And I think that's like part of our community, like, and how we embrace the Reds and they embrace the community back.
Well, I think that whether you're on the field or whether you're in the broadcast booth, the folks that listen, watch, or come to the ball games to watch you play, you know, all they really want is just a little piece. They just want to know just a little something about you. And I don't see why that's so difficult to give. I really don't. I never have when I was, I didn't understand it when I was playing, why guys wouldn't sign autographs. Don't understand why you can't just be your normal personal self while you're on TV or the radio, or you have to be so serious. I mean, people want to be entertained. They want a little bit, they want to kind of to be able to identify with the folks that they watch and listen to.
Well, speaking of entertaining, I'm going to confess to you that my brothers, I have two brothers, and we have a text thread, and it's mostly dominated by sports and especially Reds baseball. But we all like listening to the broadcast. We, you know, listen to it growing up, and we entertain ourselves by texting each other what we call the day's best Brantley-ism. And I'll give an example. The one that just cracks me up and I'll never forget is you were describing somebody who was pitching some nasty inside strikes. And you, on one of the pitches, you said, oh my, that buckled him up like a fine leather belt. And we were and we were laughing about that for days. Can I ask you, do you have those at the ready? Do you come up with them in the shower and jot them down and pull them out, you know, when the occasion arises? Or is that all just top of the mind, pure, unfiltered Jeff Brantley?
Straight up. The only thing I write down is the lineup and a few stats. The rest of it is just kind of spur of the moment, and it just happens. You know, I just hope I don't say anything that hurts anybody's feelings, because I'm just trying to be me and trying to make it fun to listen to.
Well, and speaking of trying to be you, I also wanted to ask you, aside from Tommy Thrall, you probably had one of the most challenging jobs in terms of following the person who preceded you. Generations of fans growing up with Marty and Joe, and then when Marty passed, and I mean when Joe passed and Marty needed a new partner, it was Jeff Brantley. Did you feel the weight of that situation? Were you concerned about how fans would receive you? Can you tell me what was going on in your mind right when you started in the booth with Marty?
Well, bro, I'll be honest with you. When I was growing up, now I grew up in Alabama, and I tell this story all the time, and people look at me like I've got five heads, but I used to listen to the Reds radio broadcast with Marty and Joe. And this is from the time I was about 10 years old until I was 14 or 15. And what would happen is we would sit, my dad and I would sit in the driveway, and we would listen to the radio on the car radio. The station that was 700 in Alabama, in Hoover, which is where I grew up, was a Latin station until it hit 6 o'clock at night. It was Latin all day long. So you wouldn't know that it was something that you could listen to a baseball game, especially a game in Cincinnati, unless you paid attention. And when that clock hit six, it was 7 o'clock in Cincinnati, and boom, there's Marty and Joe. But as you know, back in those days, you didn't have the ability to have the receivership that you do now. We couldn't get a clear channel, even on a big stereo inside the house. The only way you could keep it clear was not only to be in the car, but you had to be moving. So we're driving about 15 feet up towards the garage and then back up 15 feet and then drive forward. I mean, that's kind of how we listen to Reds games. It's crazy because of the way that it happened, but that's kind of how I took in Reds baseball. So I already had, at least in my mind, I already had a relationship with Marty and Joe before I ever got to college. And even though I started with the Giants, my heart was always in Cincinnati. And then when I got here and got a chance to play, I had a really special relationship with Joe Nuxall. So it wasn't as though I was taking his spot. I didn't really feel like I was taking Joe's spot. I just felt like I was just kind of, I guess the best way to say it, I felt like I was kind of keeping the seat warm. That's how I feel about it.
Talk a little bit about your friendship with Joe. You were both pitchers, obviously. Was he mentoring you as a pitcher, or were you talking about possibly a career in broadcasting with him?
No, we never really had that kind of subject. We talked about pitching, and what we talked about probably more than anything else was just having fun. I mean, Joe loved to have fun, whether he was on the radio or whether he was in the dugout doing the post-game radio show. And I would ask him, all right, well, what players are coming in, or do you need somebody? And I think that was probably one of the only times that I ever saw Joe kind of in a down moment, is because that was the transition where guys really didn't want to come out to the dugout to do the post-game show. And they just didn't want to fool with it. And it was almost like I think that was a point in time where it kind of hurt Joe's feelings, and I mean that's where that kind of post game deal just kind of faded off. We just stopped doing it, and I've kind of felt really bad for him in that moment, because that was always a highlight of the ball game for him, was to go down and celebrate the guy that had a great game. And why wouldn't you want to do that as a player? That goes back to what we were talking about earlier about celebrating with the fans. I mean, that's a cool moment after a ball game. Fans want to hear from the guy that hit the big home run or had the big strikeout at the end of the game or made the great play. I think people love to hear about that, and I wish that was something that we had now, but we just don't. And it kind of evaporated because players just didn't want to take 5 minutes to do the post-game show.
It is interesting because I feel like social media is kind of replacing that. But what people post themselves and what they're saying isn't always the number one question that people have, you know, walking away. And I feel like there is room for something like that to return, just to get the question that's on the tip of everyone's tongue answered.
Well, I like the fact that when we're at home and we do when Jim Day does the kind of the player of the game and has that excitement with the guy right when he comes off the field, I think that's a great moment for folks that like to watch TV or like to listen to the game. I just think that's really a cool time, because you don't really, as a player at that point, all of your emotions are right on the tip of your tongue. So you're still breathing hard, you're still excited, and people like to share in that. I know I do, and I'm a fan of the game. Even though I'm in the game, I'm a fan of the game. I like to see those moments, and I like for the players to be able to share when they're still breathing hard, they're getting covered with ice water, and I mean it's just a cool time when you have a victory, because everybody wants to share in a victory, whether you're on the field, part of the team, or you're in a debate just having to share because you're a fan of the Reds.
Okay, so I do feel like in you we have the expert. Okay, so I think the people listening will understand that, well, I do love the Reds as a fan. I couldn't technically talk about them. But I do know that the overarching headline is that we have all these young, amazing pitchers, and this is why, don't worry about this season, we are going to be amazing. So can you kind of give us your take on all of our young pitchers and how they're progressing and how you see them going?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm excited about the kids that we have, especially the young three, Ashcraft, Lodolo, and Hunter Green. I think that this is the one point that I'm not sure that the Reds have been here at this place and time, at least since I've been part of the club, going all the way back to when I was playing. Because the Reds as an organization have always had a difficult time developing pitchers. And I think that a lot of that credit goes to the organization, guys that signed them. But I think you have to give up the majority of that credit to the Reds pitching coach, Derek Johnson. I mean, he's done a phenomenal job. I mean, who would have ever heard of Alexis Diaz before we started this season? And yet he's probably going to be your closer marked in when we head into 2023. But I love those kids. And the reason that I do is because they believe that they're better than the guy standing at the plate. And I don't say that in a cocky way or in an arrogant way. I think that's how you have to feel when you're out there on the mound. I think whether you are or not, if you don't feel like you're better than the guy that's at the plate, then you're going to back up. You're going to take a step back. And when you're on the mound and you're a starter and you're in the big leagues and the lights are shining and the fans are screaming, you have to have some confidence. You have to feel like, okay, I'm going to get this guy out. This is my job, and I know I can get it done. And I think all three of those guys have that uplifting confidence. Do they have the experience? No, but that's coming. And I think we've seen a tremendous amount of improvement from all three of those guys. And I think you could include Diaz in that as we've moved along in this season. And regardless of how the game is played, if you can't pitch, you can't win. And all of those guys that I just mentioned, they can pitch. They're game-time players, and that gives me hope.
Okay, we'd love to hear that. We'd love it.
Me too.
So tell me how, as a broadcaster, you keep things up during a season where you're approaching perhaps maybe one of the worst records, if not the worst record in franchise history. How do you get up for work each day, you know, knowing that this season is tough, injuries, fans upset? Talk a little bit about the difference between broadcasting when the team is winning and when the team is struggling. Or is there a difference?
Well, number one, Beryl, I love baseball. And I love being able to try to teach baseball through the media of TV or on the radio. And I think for the listener, they want to start the ball game with the hope that the Reds are going to win on this day. not everybody listens every single day, even though there are a lot of people that do. I think that sometimes you're popping in or popping out when you jump in the car, or maybe you're in the on the back porch listening to the game and you're kind of in and out. People want to be able to have a positive end to their day. So you have to be upbeat, and that's how I see it. I think you have to present a positive picture. And I know I don't do that every single day simply because you get frustrated with bad plays, and bad pitches, and guys that don't hustle. I mean, that's kind of part of the game, but you try to explain it in a way where people are still excited about the future of the Reds. That's the only way I know how to do it.
And I do think this team has been surprising. Like, it's impossible to say which games they're winning and which ones they're not, you know, because they have pulled out so many surprises when you think that they're not going to, and then the opposite. And so I love the idea of staying positive. I mean, I always go to the game thinking we're going to win. Why not?
Well, I mean, why would you come to the game thinking that they're going to lose? I mean,
it's always fun to go to a game either way.
I mean, that's the hope of sports. I mean, everybody has a normal everyday job, and sports are like going to a movie or going to a play. You're coming to have a positive experience. Whether the team wins or not, you're trying to find something positive that goes on out there. I mean, let's go back to last night's ballgame. The Reds had a great first six innings with Hunter Green on the mound, and it looked like, okay, well, the team's going to win this ballgame. And then it didn't end up that way. But you come to the ballpark looking for the guy that is starting pitching, and hopefully the Reds can provide enough offense for him to win the game. It just didn't work out.
So I have a few questions, kind of rapid-fire type questions I thought would be fun to do. And we'll start with, if you're up for that.
I'm up for it.
Instead of like ask Marty, this is like ask Jeff.
Ask the Cowboy.
Ask the Cowboy, yes.
If you have a nickname like that, you always have to use it.
Which, you know, I would prefer that segment be Ask the Cowboy as opposed to Ask the Booth. Because the booth, what is the booth? The booth isn't even a person, right? I think you guys should change that to Ask the Cowboy. Just my two cents.
Little advice.
Yeah.
We're in the media.
I'll have to tell Jared Forgus about that.
Okay. I'll send her a note. All right. The batter you most feared facing as a pitcher?
Most feared?
Yes. The one who owned you.
I would say probably Gary Sheffield or Jeff Bagwell. But do I have time to tell you a little story about Bagwell?
Absolutely. We love storytelling on That So Cincinnati.
I was hoping one of these would launch you into a story, so it worked.
Bagwell was one of those kinds of hitters when he was younger, and I was pitching for the Giants. I just wore him out. The first probably 15, 16 at-bats, he couldn't do anything. He was either popping it up or striking out. Well, I had an at-bat, and I got a little bit cocky in the at-bat. He was down two strikes, and I threw the ball up and in, knocked him back, and instead of going directly to the breaking ball on the following pitch, which is what I was normally doing, I threw a second pitch up and in and knocked him down. And I think at that point, it made him irate. I think he was so frustrated and so mad that when he got back in the box, he was a totally different hitter. And the next pitch that I threw, he hit out of dead center field at Candlestick about 500 feet. One of the longer home runs I think I've ever given up. And for the next, I think, 20-something at-bats, I didn't get him out.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of passion, it does go in when you're doing sports. I could see where that, you know, stuck with him.
Huh? Yeah, so the way that I look at that is you let sleeping dogs lie. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying?
I was going to ask you what the moral of that story is for all those youngsters out there who want to be pitchers. Okay, how do you feel about the pitch clock?
I like it. I like quick action. I mean, when I was pitching, you get the ball, you throw the ball. Because if you're getting the ball and making your pitch, you're going to keep the hitter from being able to think too much about what's coming next. You keep them off balance. And that's the whole art of pitching, is keeping the guys off balance and keeping them in a position to where they're not ready for the next pitch that you're going to throw. You're supposed to be thinking one pitch ahead anyway, so you're ready to pitch.
What about the current extra inning rules with a runner starting on second, which, by the way, it annoys me that that's called a ghost runner, because having played a lot of wiffle ball in the cul-de-sac, that's not what a ghost runner is. A ghost runner is like a ghost. It's there's nobody on base,
really,
but you,
not there.
Yeah, but you know if someone would be on base, you know, for the force out or for the run driven in.
I learned something new every time. Yeah, every podcast.
I have to tell you about cul-de-sac wiffle ball rules. But how do you feel about starting that runner on second base in extra innings?
I like the run. I didn't like it in the beginning, but I'll be honest with you. Just not one of those things that I thought really should be in baseball. But after I saw it and the action that it created and the excitement in the stands when that runner started at second base, that made me happy. Because I think of myself as being a fan at the game, and what would I like? Well, anything that creates an additional influx of action, I'm all over it. And I thought that created a lot of action.
All right. Your favorite teammate on the Reds?
My favorite teammate on the Reds. Well, I would have to say that would be Jeff Shaw. And the reason I will say that is because he was as responsible for me winning the Rolaids Relief Man of the Year as I was, because you can't be a great closer without a great setup man. Because if he doesn't keep the game at hand, then you have no chance of getting a save. So that's one of the reasons that when Jeff Shaw, when we finished that year in 96, I bought him a Rolex and I took it to his house in the middle of the winter and surprised him. And right before Christmas, and his wife looked at me and she said, "Well, I guess that citizen that I have in the box under the tree is probably not going to be any good."
I'm sure he loved both of those. And he still wears the Rolex today, I'm guessing.
Well, that kind of reminds me, your battery mate was Ed Tobensee, right?
Eddie Tobensee and Joe Oliver.
How important is it to have a good relationship with your catcher?
Oh, I think it means, especially with where the Reds are right now in this youth movement pitching standpoint, I think you need a veteran presence behind the plate in some circumstances, in some way, fashion, or form. I think when you have a rookie catcher and rookie pitchers, it's kind of like the blind leading the blind. It's not a good situation. And I think we've seen some progress with Austin Romine since he has come to the Reds, with Tyler Stevenson being injured. Romine's done a phenomenal job in kind of guiding these pitchers. And I think that's what those young guys need. And I think anytime that you can make a young pitcher comfortable on the mound as a catcher, then I think they're going to be able to execute better pitches and they're going to do better. And what we're looking for is for them to be the veteran on the mound and leading those young catchers. But right now, you don't have the chance to do that. You've got young pitchers, and you need to have a catcher back there that understands what he's doing, besides having Tyler Stevenson, because Tyler can't catch every day.
You know, a friend of mine, this is an example of one of those classic arguments about baseball that really doesn't make sense, but they're fun to have. Because he's injured, and I think this was the second injury of the season, if I'm not mistaken, it seems like tall, lanky catchers like Tyler Stevenson have probably a higher chance of getting injured than, someone like Buster Posey, who's more compact. Do you think there's any merit to that, or do you think that's just one of those classic arguments over a beer that makes no sense at all?
No, I think there's something to that. I wouldn't describe Tyler Stevenson as lanky, because he's a big old boy now. He might look lean on the field, but you stand up next to him, he's a big fella. He's thick. And I think any time that you get a catcher that's 6'2", 235, they're big guys, what happens is when a foul ball comes off, it catches the last 2 inches of their body, whereas if you had a smaller catcher like we had with Tucker Barnhart, there's not as much room to hit, so the ball may miss them or glance off of some of the equipment. But when you're a big guy, there's just a lot more room to hit. And that just makes it more difficult when you're behind the plate. Is it bad for the catcher or good for the catcher? I don't know where that difference lies at this point, because there are a lot of big catchers out there, but it does mean you're going to take some more blows, and that's just kind of what you have to live with.
He is fun watching gun people down trying to steal. I think he's just coming into his own with that.
I love the abilities of catchers now, and that's one thing that the Reds work on so much. We have a great catching coach in J.R. House. I mean, if you come to the ball game and you're there early, you're going to see catchers working on the side, blocking, catching pitches, working on their framing, and being able to not throwing every day, but working on foot movement, and then they'll throw about every 3 or 4 days. I think it's shown up, because we can cut down guys on the bases.
All right, last two rapid-fire questions. Do you really eat as much ice cream as you would lead us to believe if we're listening to you on the radio?
Yes and no. I used to eat it all the time. And pretty much when I first got here with the Reds, I was eating about a carton a night. Now that's not real good for you.
But, it's yummy though.
But when you're eating Oreo cookies and cream, and it's mint ice cream, and you're eating it like close to bedtime, and you fall asleep and that melts in your lap and you wake up, that's not a real good feeling, because you really don't know if it's ice cream or not.
All right. And then...
Is that still your favorite flavor?
That is my favorite flavor. Mint ice cream with Oreo cookies.
Does Graders make this?
He's a UDF
Graders
guy.
UDF.
Oh, okay.
He's a UDF guy, Sherry.
Sorry.
Give them a free plug. Speaking of free plugs, I remember laughing too when you were talking with somebody about Montgomery and ribs, and you acted surprised that they come in smaller portions than a full slab.
I love Montgomery and ribs, and I have loved them since I first came to Cincinnati in a Giants uniform, and I was eating lunch with my agent Joe Bick over at the Boathouse, and they brought out the ribs, and I like to have it with the sauce on the side, because I'm kind of technical about how I'm eating my barbecue. I like to be able to put the right amount of sauce on there that I want, not that somebody in the kitchen wants. And I ate the first slab, and I said, can I get another one of those? And he looked at me like I had five heads. He's like, JB, you're going to eat another slab? I said, yeah, I'm going to eat another slab.
Well, back in your playing days, I'm sure, you know, you were burning through a lot of calories and things like that. Okay.
A lot of calories.
As long as we're on the topic of food,
yeah.
I did hear you have a secret weapon maybe that does keep you positive in the booth. What do you like to drink?
That would be Mexican Coke. Mm-hmm. Out of the glass bottle, and that refrigerator is slammed full.
Kareem is waving his hands up in the air. He's excited.
Yeah, Bill Reinberger keeps me loaded up with that Mexican Coke.
Well, that's great. And then finally, if you're not in the radio or TV booth, what is a perfect day for Jeff Brantley?
The perfect day for Jeff Brantley, if I'm not in the booth or at the baseball field, is spending it with my wife and my kids. I'm just a regular old cat. I love being a dad. I love being a husband, and I love family time. I love getting to, whether it's being in the backyard by the pool or playing catch in the driveway or playing horse with my son, you don't get that time back. And if you're a dad, spend time with your kids, because there's going to come a point in time where they're going to be gone.
That is truth right there.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Jeff, we thank
all right.
you.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I don't know. How much prep do you have? This is kind of early in the day. How much prep do you have to do for games? You do have one tonight.
Yeah, well, we have a day game today. Matter of fact, we're playing here in just a little bit. Most of that I'm doing prior to the series, but there is a book that you have to get done so that you can kind of keep up here in the ball game. And that takes a little bit to get that done. But it's baseball. And if it's baseball, well, that's me.
was such, that was a really good conversation.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I actually learned a lot. Like you two threw out some names that maybe I don't know, but it was great to hear. And I'm excited. It was such, I liked hearing like about our young pitchers and everything. He called them kids. I thought that was really cute and like
very fatherly of him. And it ended on that note about, you know, spending time with his family. I really enjoyed him describing the showdown between him and Jeff Bagwell. I mean, that's, to me, that is baseball, you know, the pitching inside, thinking you own the batter. And then he just, what did he say? 500-yard home run.
Yeah. And then ever after.
That's going to ruin your day if you're a pitcher.
Ever after, it was a showdown. It wasn't just in that moment.
I know, right? Well, Jeff is a great guy. And hopefully he has fun in the offseason. Is this when we talk about our Cincinnati moment of the week?
Yes.
All right. So I'm going to do something I thought I wouldn't do. And that's if we have longtime listeners that remember the early days of this podcast and how many times it was dominated by discussions about the streetcar, I want to talk about the streetcar.
And I'll
tell you why. Okay. All right. So I've mentioned, you know, I have this bobblehead collection. Okay. So I found a guy who,
I don't know where we're going with this,
you guys. Had a bobblehead that I really needed to add to my collection. It's kind of hard to get because it wasn't a wide-release bobblehead. It was kind of a special ticket bobblehead, and it was a bobblehead featuring the famous Reds bat boy, Teddy Kramer.
Okay,
Teddy, right?
How could I forget? Teddy won Dancing with the Stars the year I did it.
That's right. Oh, wow.
He was the best. He was so great. He deserved that win. I should have practiced more. He was amazing, though. All right, go ahead. We are way off topic. Go ahead, because we're going to talk about the streetcar.
And I wish I knew the organization that bobblehead benefited off the top of my head, but it was basically you know, a foundation that helps for the long-term care of special needs individuals.
Okay.
So it was just a feel good thing to do. And so my wife, Lauren, decided, hey, I want to go make candles. So there's this place in OTR. The Candle Lab, right? And I make fun of this and poo-poo it all the time because I'm like, they all smell the same to me. You know,
this is not true. Lauren, I got your back.
Well, describe people what the Candle Lab. What do you do when you go to the Candle Lab, Sherry?
So you get to pick the scents and you actually make the candles. And they're very high quality candles. That's the key. And they last a long time. They're personalized to what you like. And you know who likes these?
Who?
Alex Coolidge.
Oh, well.
I'm not the candle driver in our house. He is. It's odd, I know.
Well, I mean, we had a great time. We made our candles and everything like that. And so we're all the way up at OTR.
I love that you did that with her. Okay.
And I said, hey, I got to be down in front of the Pete Rose statue at 5 o'clock to meet this guy to purchase my, you know, Teddy Kramer bobblehead. And she said, oh, that's kind of a long walk. And I said, yeah. And the Kroger Wellness Fair was happening down there. So it wasn't like we could just drive down real easy.
That was epic. It's a whole different story.
Oh, we got to talk about that too. Well, no, there's too much to talk about. Anyway. We decided to ride the streetcar. And it was fantastic.
The streetcar is fantastic.
I don't know why you got... No, I know what the complaints are. I know all the political, the cost and everything like that.
But here's, I'm going to tell you.
But when all's said and done, okay, now it doesn't cost anything to ride. It's not the answer to our mass transportation needs by a long shot. I don't know if it's ever going to go up the hill to Clifton, which would make it a little more useful. But as far as like shuttling around downtown on a busy weekend, you want to bump up to OTR, you want to go down to the stadiums, you know, you don't want to mess around with your car. It was fantastic. It worked. It got us where we wanted to go. There were people on it, people with their overflowing swag bags from the wellness fair. Shopping bags full of stuff.
I know. And you know, there was a woman in front of me that was doing that, and I was not.
Were you at the wellness fair?
I cut through it after work on Friday.
All right.
Stay on the streetcar real quick.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So first of all, it's lovely to ride the streetcar. It gives you a nice perspective of the city because you're sitting there, you're kind of up higher, and it's a different way of looking at it, especially if you drive. Like, you're pay attention to driving and pedestrians, by the way. Right. Downtown driving is terrible. So it's a great way. And if you're going, and parking is getting more expensive, I noticed, for events. And so honestly, you guys, like, take the streetcar wherever your event is. You might be going to soccer, park at the banks, take the streetcar up, and vice versa. I do always recommend that to people because it is a good way to get to the event you're going, because it does take you all around downtown in OTR.
And it takes you, like, if you want to go to Findlay Market, and it's all on the weekends, it's always hard to park at Findlay Market. I don't want to scare people away, but you know, the streetcar will dump you right off at Findlay Market. You can get back on it, go one stop to the brewery district, yes, and hang out at Rheingeist or whatever. I mean, you know, when the streetcar was being pitched, people were making, you know, the argument that we need solutions for mass transit. We need to, you know, get people out of their cars and everything like that. It's not quite everything it was promised to be, but for what it is, and I think it does help on busy weekend downtown to just know that you can ditch your car wherever, and then you can get pretty much anywhere downtown you need to. Just jump on the streetcar. It doesn't cost anything. It's clean. It's easy to navigate. You know, it's not like the metro in DC or anything like that.
That said, there does remain, it's, there's just something about it that people do continue to argue about it. And people who love the streetcars are like, oh, the ridership's amazing. Well, oh, yes, because it's free, and that is great. And it's less cumbersome to use. It's less about the cost that it was, but it's not, you don't have that barrier of like, I have to pay for it. Oh, here it comes. I just missed it while I'm buying my ticket. And that is a great thing. And I am pro using the streetcar, so people can understand that. However, if by keeping on the ridership numbers, it's almost like making the case that Jason Williams tried to make a long time ago, which was it had low ridership, because it's always been about economic development. And back when Jason was writing what Jason was writing, he has his feelings about it, that people were like, it's about economic development, which I always agreed with because it was. And we have no metric to measure that, which is a whole nother story why we don't, and we should, because Kansas City has it. But anyway, it's time to let the streetcar politics go.
I agree. It's here.
Use it.
If you hate it, don't get on it. You know? Park on the street and get a parking ticket to make your point, right?
And how much money that is.
Exactly. So anyway, I felt, you know, that was a Cincinnati moment.
And this conversation was a Cincinnati moment on top of it.
Actually, like, using the streetcar as for what its purpose was.
All right, one last question.
Yeah.
Because we're going long, as we tend to do, apparently.
Yeah.
Do you love your bobblehead?
Oh, love my bobblehead.
Okay. Does he have a prime position now? It's Teddy.
You know, I still have it in my car. I haven't, like, figured out. Well,
you can't leave things in your car.
No, I understand that. And so I have, like, bobbleheads in the office here at the newsroom. I have some at home. So, yes, I will find a good spot for Teddy, your friend Teddy.
Okay.
And if you ever see Teddy, tell him to stop by the newsroom so he can autograph it for me.
I got it.
All right.
Okay.